This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by Berkeley Life Nitric Oxide Support Supplements. Nitric oxide is a vital signaling molecule in cardiovascular health. We all make nitric oxide in our bodies, but as we age, it starts to diminish naturally. Being proactive in maintaining nitric oxide levels is vital for healthful aging because an underperforming cardiovascular system will limit the effectiveness of any other supplementation in your regimen. Just two capsules of Berkeley Life daily provides the dietary nitrate equivalent of 7 ounces of beets and can support energy levels, maintain healthy blood pressure levels, and improve general circulation. It's the professional-grade nitric oxide supplement that I recommend and prescribe for my patients. This is only available from healthcare providers. To get your Berkeley Life professional supplements, just go to drhoffman.com/Berkeley Life. That's drhoffman.com/Berkeley Life. You can also get Berkeley Life's patented nitric oxide test strips to conveniently test your own nitric oxide levels safely and easily at home. That's drhoffman.com/Berkeley Life for Berkeley Life nitric oxide supplements. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. It's our weekly Q&A with Layla, and we're in the midst of the coronavirus pandemic, COVID-19, and of course, our theme, to some extent, has been dominated by questions related to coronavirus, but a good sign is that as we move, hopefully, towards emerging from lockdown, that may be a little premature, but at least health authorities now tell us that we are at the beginning of the end. We're not in the clear yet, but at least we're seeing, a flattening of the curve, and we're going to answer some of our regular questions. Radio program at AOL.com. We have a backlog of regular questions that have been pushed aside by the priority of dealing with COVID-19. But how are you doing, Layla? How are you experiencing the lockdown?
Okay. Sometimes bored, sometimes not. It'll be fine. How are you doing?
I think that's a normal reaction. I think that the vast majority of the populace is experiencing boredom. Although I have to commend my fellow New Yorkers for being so disciplined and really doing their part to flatten the curve. So, you know, it seems to be working. And, you know, I'm not sure when or if we'll be able to have full normalization, but at the very least, we've got an exit plan. They're sort of, you know, beginning to see faint glimmers of light at the end of the tunnel. I want to, you know, before we get into questions, by the way, the radio program at AOL.com, the usual destination for questions, and, you know, we're getting a lot of them, you know, through this Q&A with Layla. We're also getting a lot of them on my radio program that are COVID-19 related. But we're opening up to questions of any nature because, by the way, you know, in spite of the fact that we're preoccupied with coronavirus, we all have our health concerns, and none of our pre-existing health problems have dissipated. They may be somewhat eclipsed by our concern about COVID-19, but there are plenty of health problems to go around before the advent of coronavirus, right? And we never had a dearth of questions, but. Before we get to questions, very interesting article crossed my radar screen recently, and it comes to us from here in New York City, from the New York Presbyterian Hospital and Columbia University Irving Medical Center, which I happen to know because it's uptown here in New York on 181st Street. And so it services the entirety of New York City, but in particular, the community in the Bronx and also in Upper Manhattan, the so-called Inwood neighborhood, which is it's a mixed neighborhood. You know, there's a lot of diversity here. There's African-Americans. There's a lot of Hispanics. You know, there's also, you know, just a lot of New Yorkers of different nationalities up there. It is also mixed economically because there's some pretty upscale portions of it. There are also some pretty poor sections of that. And we know that those neighborhoods have been hard hit. So here's what the study says, and I found it quite surprising. it's a study that was done in their obstetric clinic, where pregnant women basically check in to, you know, healthy pregnant women check in to, you know, have their babies.
Yeah.
And so they did a survey between March 22nd and April 4, quite recently, during the height of the pandemic. And they looked at a total of 215 pregnant women. And, of course, these days, when you get into the hospital, even if you seem ostensibly healthy, they screen you for COVID-19.
Yeah.
And what they found is that a very, very, very small percentage, only 4 out of 215 women, had fever or other symptoms of COVID-19 on admission. And it turns out that out of those 4, all 4 women tested positive for SARS-CoV-2. Okay? So not that surprising. But again, that was less than 2%. So then they looked at all the women, regardless of whether they had symptoms. And these women were fine. They were healthy. They were going to give birth.
Yeah.
They were young women. They did these nasal swabs. They collected them from 210 of the women who did not have symptoms of COVID-19. And of these women, 13.7% were positive for SARS-CoV-2. So that's a pretty astonishing symptom, a pretty astonishing statistic. And what it suggests, it's sort of a bad news, good news scenario. It means that the virus has spread far and wide here in New York. But it also suggests these women were asymptomatic. They didn't even know they had it. And that suggests that a lot of us may have already been exposed here in New York.
Yes.
And we may have acquired immunity to coronavirus. Which is a very, very interesting statistic. And it suggests that, you know, there's a bad news, good news picture here in New York, because on the one hand, a lot of us have been exposed, but a lot of us may have acquired immunity. And that may not be the case in other are seemingly more fortunate parts of the country. You know, like, I doubt if the statistics are going to be like that in, Pocatello, Idaho, right?
Right, right. Interesting, this finding.
Huh. Yeah. So, you know.
Does that make then the case for everyone in America to be tested?
Absolutely, it makes that case. And there's, you know, two ways to test, and I'll just review it for our listeners. Is the one is the test that they did here, which tests for the presence of the virus, an active infection, and the potential to transmit it. It might miss the boat on people who've already had it and who have cleared the virus, and they may have acquired immunity. That's the so-called antibody test.
Yeah.
Now, the test for the nasal swab, or now an oral swab, they're variations on the theme. That test can be done very quickly, but it involves either an oral swab or a nasal swab. You can't do it with a finger stick. But even more cheaply and at a much faster rate, we can do finger sticks for people in the future. These tests have not been fully vetted and approved because they're still working out the kinks to measure the antibodies. And the antibodies will tell us who's been exposed. Now, the problem is we don't even quite yet know how to interpret these antibody tests, because what's the meaning of a positive IgM of a certain level or positive IgG? Will it confer true immunity on people? Can they really go back to work? Are they completely invulnerable to reinfection? Time will tell. We don't know the answers on that, but it's highly likely that this will behave like other viruses, where you can either require temporary or maybe long-term or lifelong immunity. So, you know, we're very much looking forward to the introduction of the antibody test as opposed to this test. So that, I mean, I'm going to rush to get that test myself, and I'm going to rush to implement that test for our patients. And it may be the so-called immunity passport or immunity certificate they were looking for to get people back out and about, going back to work, to school, you know, to social events. Because once you have your passport stamped with that, so to speak, you're going to be eligible to get back out there. So. Mm-hmm. I think that's the way back. And, you know, I want to ask you, Leila, do you have concerns? I mean, if the government mandates that, you know, you carry some sort of you know, card or wristband, or that you have some sort of app on your phone that indicates whether you've had the test and whether you're in the clear. I mean, some people have some civil liberties concerns about, you know, a governmental mandate that you do that. I know some other countries are doing that pretty aggressively, like South Korea, you know, which is a democratic country, but it's, you know, it's all got a little bit of an authoritarian statist kind of overtone.
Yeah, I don't like the idea at all for that reason. Yeah. I mean, how much time you got? I could talk about this all day long.
Right.
Our civil liberties, honestly.
But on a voluntary basis, you know, I think it might be something
voluntary
to...
Voluntary would be fine.
Yeah.
Everything voluntary would be fine.
Yeah. In other words, so you could say, look, I've been tested. You know, it's kind of like, you know, you're on the dating scene. You go in a, you know, in a bar. I mean, especially the way it used to be in the, you know, the 90s or something like that. And the first question would be like, have you had your HIV test? Show
right.
me the results, you know.
Oh, my goodness. That's right. Yeah.
Right. And
yeah.
It's like, if you haven't, it's like, well, you know, you pays your money and you takes your chance, so to speak. You know, I mean, actually became, you know, a real consideration, I think, you know, when that epidemic was raging.
Yeah.
You know, how are you going to know?
Yeah.
Anyway, so... you know, then again, you know, the accuracy of the test, we have to really prove that the test is fail-safe, and we're not quite there yet. Even the nasal swabs are, there are some reports that people test negative and then they test positive. And the implication is like, oh my God, they were healed and then they got it again. I've talked to a lot of people who say those tests are only about 70% accurate. Maybe the time that they got tested the time before, it got missed. And then a more careful test or a more sensitive test picked up the continued presence of the virus in people who are recovering.
Right, right. Yeah. And what about if you've had it, you've healed, and you get it again? I mean, where does all this stop?
Yeah.
When do we say stop? Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, you know, a lot of questions remain. I've talked about that in some of my articles. I'm actually pretty pleased with the pace of the science, and you know, it's like a real Manhattan Project. You know, when we rushed to build the atomic weapon before the Germans built the atomic weapon. Actually, this is something that I'm, you know, in my spare time I'm reading about, is that it really was touch and go during World War II. Is we didn't know how far along the Germans were, and God forbid, you know, that they had nuclear weapons before we did. They would not have had any kind of humanitarian restraint about deploying those weapons on major cities and on civilian populations. So... So we raced, you know, got all the best minds together, as we're doing with this. Science proceeded at a relatively a snail's pace in that era, although there was great urgency. And because of modern communications and technology, we're starting to get some answers a lot faster than we might have if this had happened, you know, 50 years ago. So, you know, kudos to the people on the front lines who are figuring this out. Kudos to the people in the hospitals.
I hear clapping every evening at 7 p.m.
Yeah, in your neighborhood too. You know, there's we kind of bang our pots and pans and, you know, hoot and holler and clap. And, you know, there's a kind of a clamor at 7 o'clock. You know, sometimes if I'm watching TV, I go, oh my goodness, I'm hearing it through the windows. It's,
know,
it's kind of become a New York tradition. So, all right. I actually have a question. Actually, a comment and a question. From Lewis. Hi, Dr. Hoffman. Hope you are well. Do you ever think the government will come to you or other holistic doctors for input on this virus or others down the road? Just gets me so mad that there are so many natural remedies out there and people still cry to the government for solutions. All the best. Signed, Lewis. And there's a part two to this, but let me address this. I've been there, done that with natural solutions to epidemics. And I'll tell you a true story is that back in, I think it was 1988 or 1990, I went down to Washington at the invitation of a couple of legislators. One was a representative in Congress, Berkeley Bedell from Iowa, and another was Tom Harkin. And both of them were advocates for natural approaches to disease. And when the AIDS epidemic came up, we didn't have any answers. There was no conventional treatment that was working, and people were dying in droves, and it was horrible. And we had approaches in natural medicine that we thought could help, intravenous vitamin C and other herbal therapies. And so I came down as a representative of the integrative medicine community to meet with a young official at the National Institute of Allergy and Immune Diseases, NIAID. And the name of that young official, he was in his 30s, early 40s, was Anthony Fauci.
Oh, can I guess? Oh, okay. You beat me to it. Anthony Fauci,
It
right?
was Anthony Fauci. And Anthony, so here I was sitting at a table across from Anthony Fauci, you know, the research scientist. Yep. And I was flanked by two powerful legislators who controlled the purse strings on his agency at the National Institutes of Health. And so he had to listen, right? And he listened politely. And I, you know, gave my spiel. And at the end of it, he kind of nodded and sort of, you know, acknowledged it and said, well, you know, what you're saying is very persuasive. I had case histories of patients with HIV who were improving and, you know, seemed to be doing well. And he said, oh, that's very interesting. He says, we need more studies. Does it sound familiar? You know, like hydroxychloroquine.
Every scientist at the end of their monologue will be, but we need more studies. And please, get the funding coming.
And, right. And the net result of it was that we made some progress because as a result of that, they founded something called the OAM, the Office of Alternative Medicine, which they changed the name of it. It became the National Center for Complementary and Alternative Medicine, which exists to this day. So we made some inroads. However, it turns out that with the AIDS epidemic, the people who are doing conventional approaches to that ultimately prevailed because we came up with some really plausible conventional treatments that have basically stopped the disease in its tracks.
Yes,
and the natural treatments for HIV have really kind of fallen by the wayside. Here we are, you know, fast forward 30 years. You okay? You got your mask on? And
Well, I don't know. You're going to have to call 911 because I coughed.
Okay. I'm going to have the, I think I'm going to have the FBI and the local authorities come to your place and just bring you to the Javits Center where we can quarantine you, you know, and put you under observation.
No, put me on comfort.
Okay.
I want to go on a boat.
Yeah. Oh, you want to go on the boat? Okay.
I want to go on the boat.
You might as well because there's a lot of room on that boat. They didn't have to use that, you know. But anyway, so true story. So, you know, to answer Anthony's question, yes, you know, clearly we need more studies. I do know people in the natural health community who are more, shall we say, situated within universities and medical centers who are able to mount studies. However, I think it's still going to be the minority opinion on this. And, you know, what else is new is that we tend to relegate these therapies to second-class status. And I'm not here to say that we've got some magic bullets, you know, take elderberry or, you know, garlic or something like that, and that's going to be the panacea. But these therapies need to be studied. You know, for example, studies are underway to see if vitamin D is crucial in modulating the immune response of people with this. That's actually being studied. Intravenous vitamin C, not in the United States, but in China. We'll actually report on that next week. I'm going to talk to one of our top experts on vitamin C research to report to us on what's happening across the world and in China. I know they're using a little vitamin C in hospitals here, not nearly enough.
I was just going to ask you about that. Yeah, I'm hearing random stories like that. I hopefully that will grow because
They're just throwing
good
a little
antiviral medicine.
Yeah, they're throwing just a little bit in the IV bag, not as much as we would do in, you know, for a patient who has a cold or a flu.
You're not getting 50 grams of vitamin C.
Exactly. So anyway, so the second part of the question from Lewis is hope all is well. Oh, this just came in a couple of days ago. I have a question for your radio show. Well, he doesn't know that we're supposed to send email to radioprogram@AOL.com. Since a lot of elderly are dying from corona nursing homes, do you think their D levels should be checked regularly? And are there any drugs that deplete the body of D similar to the way statins lower people's coenzyme Q10 levels? Mm-hmm. And so that's a really good question. A colleague recently shared that she has a patient who is taking 50,000 international units of vitamin D for a low vitamin D three times a week. That's quite a lot. You know, if you do the math, that's like 25,000 a day. That should be plenty. So when they test that person's vitamin D levels, that person's vitamin D levels persists at 14, which is extremely low. So then, but I looked at the list of medications that this patient was on, and they're on like, you know, 10 or 12 different medications. And one of the medications is something called cholestipol, which is a bile acid sequestrant. I'm not sure why that patient is on such a medication. But those interfere with fat-soluble nutrients. And my theory is that, you know, the vitamin D that she's taking is being grabbed on by the cholestipol and just conducted out of the body. So do you know of any other depletions, any other medications that deplete vitamin D? Would the anticonvulsants do that? Is that possible?
There would be steroid medications, anti-seizure medications as well. And, you know, you'd have to inquire about kidney and liver disease because that's where the D is manufactured.
Yes, yeah, exactly. The conversion is important.
The conversion, yeah.
To make 25-hydroxyvitamin D, that's a, I believe that's limited by the kidneys.
Right.
And that the 125 would be inhibited by liver. You know, clearly there could be some problems with metabolism or absorption, you know, elderly patients, you know, I really think that any nursing home that's not giving their patients vitamin D, is guilty of malpractice. What say you?
I hear that. Yeah. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I think that would, and also checking levels would be important. You know, I know that Medicare is now discouraging routine testing for vitamin D. But I think that under the circumstances of this challenging epidemic, I think it becomes even more urgent to check the status, particularly of vulnerable people with pre-existing conditions, obesity, old age, to check their vitamin D, because that, I think, is an important determinant of who goes down the rabbit hole with this.
Exactly. It's known as the antibiotic vitamin. Not that an antibiotic would be appropriate in this case because it's a virus. However, it's good for immunity.
Yep.
It's that important. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. So your vitamin D in so many ways affects immunity. On the one hand, it seems to increase resistance, but lest you be concerned that it's going to over-amp your immune response, we have to keep in mind that we actually use vitamin D to tamp down over-exuberant immunity in autoimmune conditions like multiple sclerosis. And
it's like a natural immunomodulator.
Modulator is the word. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's Goldilocks.
Yes.
It's to tame your immune system to that level.
Right. Not too hot, not too cold, just right.
All right.
Yeah, good. Okay, so shall we hear what's in the mailbag?
Yes.
We got to do? Per request, let's get in a little mention from one of our sponsors. So here goes. This is Dr. Ronald Hoffman with one of my personal solutions to better cardiovascular health, Berkeley Life Nitric Oxide Support Supplements. Just 2 capsules of Berkeley Life daily provide the dietary nitrate equivalent of 7 ounces of beets and can support cardiovascular health, maintain healthy blood pressure levels, and improve overall circulation. For more information and to purchase, just go to drhoffman.com/berkeleylife. drhoffman.com/berkeleylife. Berkeley Life Nitric Oxide Support Supplements. Thanks for listening. Thanks for supporting our sponsors. They're what make intelligent medicine a continuing free resource to you. Now go ahead and read the question.
All right. We've got a follow-up from Chris, who last week asked us about taking quinine pills in low doses to prophylactically protect against COVID-19.
Yeah, we didn't think that's a good idea.
Yeah, yeah. So he said, thank you for answering that question. During your last podcast, you explained that one of the ways that hydroxychloroquine may work is by making the blood more alkaline. Since viruses can't survive as well in an alkaline blood environment, would you recommend any action to proactively increase the pH levels in our bodies, such as taking apple cider vinegar every day?
Yeah, that would seem like...
I actually went into this on my own podcast in about the question about alkalinity and how in our serum, in our blood, that pH level is very, very tightly controlled.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's one thing to make the body more alkaline, eat more alkaline foods, and if you test with urine strips, you will find that for several hours after having a very alkalinizing meal like, oh, your kale smoothie, that your urine test strip will show some more alkalinity. But as the body always likes to do, it likes to go back into equilibrium.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So that's really ultimately what it wants to achieve. But even more so in the blood, it's pretty tightly controlled at about 7.4, which is slightly alkaline.
Mm-hmm.
Taking apple cider vinegar every day is going to change your blood pH.
Right.
Not by much.
It's very, very, very modest.
It did open for a little while, yeah.
So, but actually, what he's saying, it kind of makes sense from what I said, but it was a little bit overly simplistic when I said hydroxychloroquine creates a more acid environment. I'm sorry, a more alkaline environment for the virus. The way that the virus gets taken into the cell is it kind of gets enveloped by the cell membrane, and it creates like a little bubble, which sort of brings the virus inside the cell to the nucleus. And that bubble has some either more or less acid or alkaline environment. And hydroxychloroquine, for some reason or another, it is a rather alkaline compound, has the ability to enter these little bubbles, and within the bubbles create a little bit more of an alkaline environment. That's even just speculation. We're not even quite sure exactly how it works. And the alkaline environment may inhibit the virus in some way. So, okay. You know, nice try. Nice. It's sort of an extrapolation from what I said.
Yeah. But,
you know,
it's good thinking. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I think it's not going to, you know, it's kind of like, you know, it's like the old joke is, you know, it's Ford's Theater. And the play is going on. Abraham Lincoln is in the balcony, and the shots ring out. And, you know, Abraham Lincoln, you know, slumps forward. And the actor on the stage, remember, this is a Jewish joke. And the actor on the stage says, "Oh, my God, the president's been shot." And somebody in the audience yells out, "Give him a little chicken soup." And there's a silence, and so the you know, the actor on the stage says, "But that wouldn't help." And the guy in the audience says, "Yeah, but it wouldn't hurt."
What's a little Jewish penicillin? Come on.
Right. Okay. So I mean, that's an old Yiddish joke.
Yeah.
All right. Anyway, so let's pause on that note.
And, oh my.
And we're gonna. You didn't think you'd hear this kind of stuff, but okay. And by the way, on that chicken soup, results may vary, so don't try this at home.
If yes. You've
been, you know, shot in the temple with a derringer. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is our weekly Q&A with Layla.